to America is be true to what you said on paper.
The World Arts Foundation Incorporated and KBOO would like to invite you to its 32nd annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, located at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Invited guests will include a multitude of speakers and performances that includes the Portland Interfaith Gospel Choir and choirs from the Portland Public Schools, African drumming, and the acclaimed Jefferson Dancers, and much, much more. Monday, January 16th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., live right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Keep alive the dream.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Matt Samet. Matt is a freelance writer and editor. His stories have appeared in Climbing magazine and Outside and Backpacker. He lives near Boulder, Colorado, and he's a former professional rock climber who was diagnosed with panic, depression, and bipolar disorder, and for 13 years battled an addiction to prescribed benzodiazepines. Matt has now been off of all psychiatric medications for 6 years, and he just released a new memoir, which is called Death Grip, A Climber's Escape from Benzo Madness. So welcome to Madness Radio, Matt Samet.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for having me on.
Matt, you've been through a really inspiring story of recovery from benzodiazepine addiction, and I want to congratulate you both on having made it to the other side and being off of the medications that you were struggling with for so many years. And also this really powerful book that you've just come out with, Death Grip, about your whole experience. And I think that more people really need to hear about benzodiazepine addiction and the problems with prescribed psychiatric medications.
Thanks, Will. I feel fortunate, to be honest, to have survived and to be able to tell the tale the way I have. So yeah, it's definitely good to be here. Good to be on the other side.
And I want to get into the story of how it really began with you through your passion for rock climbing. But give us just a brief sense of what it is that we're talking about here. I mean, what were the medications that you were addicted to? What did they do to you? And then how was it that you came out of it?
I was given this class of tranquilizers known as benzodiazepines for panic attacks and a quote-unquote panic disorder. You know, what they do in the body is they potentiate the action of the calming neurotransmitter GABA. So they sort of still the nervous system to a certain degree. The most common forms are Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan. You know, these are probably the names that people recognize. At different times, I was on and off antidepressants, mood stabilizers like lithium, anti-epileptics like Neurontin, Trileptal. They tried antipsychotics on me. You know, they were just sort of throwing meds at me there for a while. You know, what happened with me is kind of tangled. You know, at one point I had abused Valium, which wasn't prescribed to me, but the prescribed benzos, you know, started out small with just little doses to take here and there if I was having a high anxiety day or to stop a panic attack. But basically from 1998 until 2005, I was on them continuously, daily. The idea was that this was a sort of prophylactic treatment, you know, to prevent panic attacks. And so during that time, I went from 2 milligrams of Ativan a day to 3 to 4, switched to Klonopin. By the time I realized I'd had enough, I was on 4 milligrams of Klonopin a day, which is a lot. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot. And that was in early 2005. And at that point, I began to taper. So I did not get off until December of 2005.
And your withdrawal process was really quite horrendous coming off of those drugs.
Yes, it was. It was hellish. I mean, the thing is that I don't think I was an anomaly and that my withdrawal was hellish. I just think I didn't know what to expect. You know, what happened is to me, as I worked on a taper with my psychiatrist at a rate that he agreed sounded fine, you know, probably was much slower than what he would have recommended. You know, but over the course of the, let's say, 9 to 10 months that I tapered, my anxiety got worse and worse and worse until eventually I became housebound. And during this period, because I'd entered what I now recognize was a chemically very perilous and fragile state, you know, I kept turning to the same doctor and to other doctors because I thought there was something profoundly wrong with me, not just, oh, this is what it's going to be like when you go to taper these highly addictive drugs that you've been on for years. So during that time, they put me on and off so many other meds, and I was hospitalized 3 times, and all these other diagnoses were coming at me. So, you know, I think what made it especially bad was not only the symptoms, which are bad enough, but not being told that these were simply symptoms, but being told that this was how I feel when I'm quote unquote off meds. And then also being made very, very sick by these other chemical agents that were often given to me against my will.
There was an unwillingness or an inability of the doctors that you were seeing to say, look, these are all withdrawal symptoms of the drugs. They were really saying, well, this is really your panic disorder, or this is really your bipolar, or this is your underlying mental illness, rather than saying, wow, this is an effect of the medications that you've been given.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was zero acknowledgement that benzos could cause anything that they were causing. I mean, what I kept being told by all these people, from the doctors to the nurses on down, was that I had the worst reaction to going off benzos of anyone they'd ever seen, which, you know, to me, it seems like total BS.
Because that's actually quite common. I mean, I'm contacted by many, many people, and we've actually interviewed some on Madness Radio who have struggled in similar ways with a horrendous withdrawal process and just terrible, terrible experience coming off of benzodiazepines, whether it's Xanax or Valium or Ativan or Klonopin. Any of them can have really severe withdrawal effects coming off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, the doctor I was working with basically, I think without even realizing what he was admitting, would just keep telling me, well, he'd seen other people try, but then they'd get lower in their dose and freak out and go back on, which to me right there is clearly evidence that I wasn't an outlier, that I just happened to stick with it because I wanted my life back. And this quote-unquote anxiety expert therapist I was seeing kept saying, well, every person she'd worked with who came in who wanted help getting off benzos had ended up in the hospital, which again said to me, the message is wrong. The message that if you're experiencing extreme anxiety while tapering means that there's something wrong with you is completely backwards. I mean, if someone had said, this is extreme anxiety, but this is probably the correct thing to feel because your body's readjusting, then I certainly would have had a better toolkit for coping with it.
So Matt, let's talk about your story about how you began this whole process, because you were very, very passionate as a rock climber, and this was a love that you have and still have, and then yet that passion started to become a problem, and that became your entry point into psychiatric drug prescription. So tell us about that.
You know, I basically sabotaged myself. I've always loved climbing since I was a teenager, and rock climbing in particular. I've sort of done a little bit of everything. And in rock climbing, quote unquote performance rock climbing, where you're trying to sort of push your standards, and free climbing, which is just simply moving up the rock with fingers and toes, you're not waiting the rope for progress, but you have the rope on to catch a fall. It helps to be lean. The strength to weight ratio is very important, because you're hanging all your weight off your fingers. Your forearm muscles tire out pretty quickly, especially on overhanging rocks. So, you kind of want to be a light little monkey. And I took that a little bit too much to heart, and then really just didn't eat for years and years and years, just trying to keep my weight lower than it should be. And so,
what is it about climbing that inspires you so much? What do you love so much about being on the rock and scrambling up and grabbing the next hold and making it to the top? What is it that's so incredibly compelling to you about that?
You know, there's a lot of things that spoke to me about climbing. Well, I suppose number one is the beauty of the places you get to visit. You're seeing these places and you're getting a view of the world that is completely unique. I mean, we all see cliffs. We all know what they are. You know, you can drive into Yosemite and And there's El Capitan right there. And it's amazing to see whether you're a climber or not. But then to be up on something like that as a human being, I think gives you a very unique and humbling perspective on the world. So that's always been a big part of it. I just simply love being in the mountains. I think also the movement, you know, like anything, whether you're a cellist or a fly fisherman or a target shooter or a mogul skier, there's that sort of flow and that kinesthetic pleasure you derive from your activity. And I think in climbing, I've noticed that if I don't climb for a week, I start to get kind of twitchy, like my muscles crave it. So I think there was a certain connection with that gymnastic aspect of climbing as well. It feels good to my body for whatever reason.
And that really led you to start starving yourself in order to have this strength to weight ratio that would allow you to climb better.
It did. I moved to Boulder in the early 1990s, and this is a main climbing town in the United States, you know, a main town for outdoor athletics. And in the early 90s, climbing what's called sport climbing, which is the bolt protected gymnastic climbing, was a pretty new thing. And people did not know much about training and much about diet and much about how to even approach this. You know, it was barely 5-7 years old. And so I moved to Boulder, and kind of everyone was really skinny. And the big thing was like not eating fat and seeing how thin you are. And, you know, we're all kind of going around with our shirts off. And, you know, in retrospect, it was all pretty silly. People know, I think, a lot more now about how to eat properly and then train a little harder. You know, so it's like, so what if you're carrying 5 or 10 extra pounds? You just train a little harder. But back then, yeah, everyone just thought. There was just this whole sort of ethos of all, yeah, I'm basically anorexia in a way. Food limiting your intake, limiting the types of calories.
And that started to catch up with you, because that can really wreak havoc on your body and your brain and your emotions if you're not feeding yourself properly.
Yeah, it did. You know, I remember before I really started having panic attacks, that same year, I would just, during periods when I ate the least, I remember having this all-encompassing sort of sense of dread, and I could never figure out why. I just knew it was there. And, you know, I didn't make the connection that it had to do with my poor diet. I mean, probably with not getting enough fat. I just thought, wow, you know, I'm sort of scared of everything right now.
And at what point did the anxiety really start to reach a limit that you felt like, look, this is something I've got to get some help with, or I've got to change?
When I was 21, around spring break, I think 1992, I'm sorry, winter break, 1992, I started to have panic attacks, which I'd never had before. I'd experienced anxiety, but I'd never had, you know, a panic attack.
At some point, it got so bad that you decided to seek help from doctors. Is that what happened?
I did, yeah. It was my sophomore year in college, and I actually went home for Christmas break and didn't seek help while I was there, because I was just freaked out. I had been in a hospital before when I was 15. I really didn't want to have much to do with therapy or psychiatry, you know, ever again. But it had gotten so bad I could, again, barely leave the house. So I returned to Colorado, and I found a good psychologist who actually helped me a lot. But, you know, part of that also is a referral onto a psychiatrist. So that would have been my first sort of tangle with meds. I'd been on like an antidepressant for a few days when I was 15 and got a rash and been off it. But until that point in my life, I'd never really been on psychiatric medication.
So you started to see this psychologist, and then what happened next?
So he was very helpful, and we had a workbook, and it helped me get a hold of my panic symptoms pretty well. I saw a psychiatrist, and we were trying out different antidepressants. SSRIs were just booming then. I mean, this was the early 90s, right? So I ended up, I think, on Paxil was the only one I could tolerate. And even that was at the minimal dose. It was at 10 milligrams. But I took it. And he also gave me some benzos to take, some lorazepam or Ativan to take as needed. And, you know, I'd never had a benzo before. And I was kind of scared to take them. And then one night I took one just out of curiosity. And they did work at first. You know, they did work. Any sort of anxious, rushing thoughts I was having were simply eradicated by the action of these pills. So that would be the first time I ever took a benzo.
That must have been a pretty miraculous feeling. Wow, you take this pill and it's all eradicated. It's just not there.
Yeah, it did. It was, to use a cliche, right? It was too good to be true. And I think I had some awareness of that too. I was like, wow, if this does this simply, you know, without much or really any effort on my part, then I need to be very cautious about these pills, because there's got to be a flip side to it.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Matt Samet. He's a freelance writer and editor who lives near Boulder, Colorado. He's a former professional rock climber who was diagnosed with panic, depression, and bipolar, and battled benzodiazepine addiction for 13 years. Matt is the author of Death Grip, A Climber's Escape from Benzo Madness. So what happened next? So you were given this prescription for Ativan. You were given some cautions, but when you took it, you were like, wow, this really works. It gets rid of my anxiety. This Ativan really is something that's treating my panic. So then what happened?
Well, I got myself into real trouble my senior year in college, 95, 96. You know, by that point, I discovered that, yeah, these benzos work, and that, I mean, I should just admit it, I did like taking them, both because I got rid of the anxiety, but because of how they made me feel. It was just this feeling of calm that was so hard to come by otherwise. So my senior year in college, I began to abuse Valium recreationally and got into a real hole with that. And sometime that spring, I just got really disgusted with myself. I was like, all right, clearly you've become a drug addict. Like, this is not working. You know, I could barely climb. I was all kind of jelly limbed and sort of like losing muscle tone and, you know, just looking like, I don't know, like I was in a rock band or something, all kind of pallid and numb. I stopped cold turkey, and that was very problematic. I ended up in the hospital here because it caused, you know, psychosis. Stopping cold turkey is a very common symptom. And I'm lucky that that's all that happened.
And all this was triggered by the cold turkey, the abrupt withdrawal from the Valium. And then you were in the hospital, and then you came out of the hospital. So this was only the very beginning of a longer process. So then what happened?
Oh, well, it should have been the end of the process if I had a shred of common sense. But, you know, I was kept there for 3 days. They made sure I was okay. The worst of that kind of psychosis passed. It would have been helpful to have been told at that point that I would feel kind of out of it, you know, sick and a little bit crazed even for months, if not a year or two. But no one said that. So I left. I was told to go to NA. I went to one meeting, but there was no one there, so I blew that off. You know, and I managed to stay away from benzos for the most part for like another year, a year and a half. And then in 97 or 98, I just didn't feel that good still. I'd been on Cipro for a tick bite, a tick-borne infection, and Cipro is a quinolone antibiotic. And those are quite bad to take if you're in a withdrawal state. You know, this wasn't really known at that point. I couldn't have looked that up on the internet like you can now. And I think taking that Cipro sort of re-triggered a lot of that stuff. And I ended up back in another psychiatrist's office saying, look, I'm pretty depressed. I'm pretty anxious. What should we look at? And so at that point, I started back on, I think, Paxil and back on benzos.
And then what happened when you started taking the Ativan again?
You know, I was taking it here and there, and then that became two a day, and I just didn't know that much about the situation. My understanding now is that, of course, they work at first. You know, they're efficacious at first for anxiety, which is exactly why they're prescribed. But, you know, what I didn't know is that in a month or two, I was going to build a tolerance, and then they weren't treating anything, you know. In fact, they were going to be exacerbating my anxiety problem. So I do know now that that is what happened. You know, within a month or two, I just had to take them to stave off tolerance withdrawal. And
so once that tolerance builds up and then you're taking it to stave off the withdrawal, then you're addicted. That's at that point is when you're addicted.
Yeah. And I was fully addicted. I mean, I tried twice in 1999 to quit, and I got down to, I think, a quarter milligram of Ativan, and I just couldn't pull the trigger on that last little bit. I'd just fold and go right back on to 2 milligrams, and clearly that should have been a sign. You know, I'd sort of do it on my own without telling the doctor I was trying to quit, and Again, I don't even know if like the Ashton manual was online at that point or what, and I certainly didn't go looking for information, but I was just...
So the Ashton manual is a really valuable resource for all these issues around benzodiazepine addiction and coming off. Heather Ashton from the UK has been really helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I believe that book saved my life.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about here in terms of a withdrawal process and in terms of like struggling with the symptoms of benzodiazepine addiction, what was it like? What was it, the experience for you of being inside of that? Because that really sounds like that was one of the most difficult times of your life.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible, horribly bleak. I mean, benzos are really disinhibiting, so my behavior was pretty far from how I am now. I mean, I was pretty quick to anger and much more sort of extroverted than I am now, which is pretty painful, actually, if you're an introvert. You know, what happens with an updose when you're in tolerance withdrawal is you get some temporary relief, and you're pretty desperate. And so you just think, oh, thank God, I don't feel what I felt last week. Thank God the panic attacks have subsided. Thank God I'm getting some sleep. You know, with all the while probably lying to yourself a little bit that this is just simply how you'll feel now that you're on the correct dose of the medication. It's all about dosages, right? So, but then a month later, every time I was updosed, I'd be in a worsening hell, you know, of anxiety and panic and that. And so for me, it began to feel pretty hopeless because I thought, I'm totally addicted to these things and I'm moving in the wrong direction now, but I don't know how to get off because I'm so hopelessly addicted.
Matt, what did you really need at that point? What would have helped you at that point when you were so far down in this terrible addiction and the tolerance withdrawal and needing the next dose of those benzodiazepines? What would have helped you?
I think what would have helped me would have been reading the Ashton manual and realizing the root cause of what I was feeling.
So when was the turning point, Matt? When did you start, looking to yourself rather than looking to other people to start to figure out how to deal with the situation?
I mean, to be honest, Will, I didn't reach that point until the end of 2005 after my final hospitalization. All through 2005, I was trying to reclaim my life and my self-sufficiency with this self-guided taper, but because I was also still seeing psychiatrists and a therapist who I think was a true believer in psychiatry, I still was looking outside myself for answers. A big turning point after the final hospitalization was meeting another survivor, Allison Kelliger, who was here in Boulder and had been through all this exact same stuff. And it actually started a benzo support group, and just seeing another human being and her empathy and her wisdom, she'd gone into counseling to help people through this very thing, was huge, to know that for the first time I wasn't alone.
And then Matt, how did you get from there to where you are now? And how did you actually pull yourself out of that terrible, terrible hole that you were in?
Well, I certainly listened to Allison and saw that time was going to be my best healer. I got involved with a support group on Yahoo, which was very good for sharing stories and symptoms and things like that. I had distanced myself from psychiatry. I was still on, I think, one med at that point. So I found a general practitioner to help me off because I knew if I went to a psychiatrist, I knew exactly what would happen. And I really just gave myself time. I mean, it was very, very hard. It was hard to always be hopeful. It was hard to always think that time was going to heal this because, for some years, I could still have very bad days, if not very bad weeks or months. So not knowing how far the finish line was away and all those things, there's a lot of doubt through those years. But again, the main thing I did to get better was I just waited, which maybe sounds overly simple, but it's true.
Tell us a little bit more about your whole process with what it actually took, what it all ended up looking like, and now how it is that you know that you've really come out the other side of it.
Well, I think that given the long time frame that I needed to heal and the uncertainty that I would heal, one thing that was huge for me especially on the bad days, was looking at what I could do. You know, I know it's our sort of human tendency to focus on the negative. So say it's 2 years in and you're still uncomfortable driving. You're like, you know, I can't drive. My life's over. But maybe that's not entirely true. Maybe it's you can't drive on the highway, but in the last few months, you've been able to drive down to the store. And I think looking at each success and appreciating it and savoring it was huge for me, because my healing was very up and down, very erratic. You know, I'd have a great week only to be plunged into hell another week. I think another thing that helped me get better was learning to recognize triggers that would set me back on my healing, things like heat and stress and just the sort of common things that make us feel bad. And then saying, oh yeah, that's why my symptoms are worse now. Not because, you know, the universe hates me or because I'm not going to get better, because it's 100 degrees out and, you know, my boss is shouting at me or whatever. You know, it's been now about 7 years total since I've been off all meds. And I know I'm better, really, because I can climb a well again. For me, is that I feel like I'm back in my body again. And climbing is just one thing a person can do. But, you know, whatever it is that you do that sort of makes you you, I think that one thing that we all have that we love the most, I know that when I felt like I could do it again in the way that I remembered savoring it before benzos, that's when I considered myself healed. And I think milestones like that are very important for people.
For people who are listening and maybe are needing resources or to find out more information, what are some of the key places that you would send them to really understand this whole process of benzodiazepine withdrawal?
You know, the site where I started was benzo.org.uk with the Ashton Manual, and that, I think, was a very valuable site for me. There's plenty of other good ones on the web these days, too. I read a lot of Peter Bragan's books and Robert Whitaker's books. There's books specifically on benzos, like Worse Than Heroin, the Benzo book. Recover and Renewal, I think, is a very valuable book by Bliss Johns. So I do think there's a lot more information out there than ever about this, which is great.
And Matt, remind us the name of your new book and also how people can get in touch with you and find out more.
The book is called Death Grip, A Climber's Escape from Benzo Madness. It's published by St. Martin's Press. So if you Google Death Grip plus St. Martin's, it'll take you to my author page with them. I also have a Facebook page up, just Matt Sammet, M-A-T-T-S-A-M-E-T. And I've been blogging also for Mad in America. And my blog there is called The Other Side.
Matt Sammet, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks, Will, for having me on. This has been great.
He's a former professional rock climber who, for 13 years, battled an addiction with benzodiazepines and has now been off of all psychiatric medication for 6 years. And he's the author of the recent book, Death Grip, A Climber's Escape from Benzo Madness, published by St. Martin's Press. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Hollow Sidewalk's Year of the Field Mouse record release show, Wednesday, January 18th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Holocene in Portland. Year of the Field Mouse is the second album by Hollow Sidewalks. Also playing the show is Sleddy Hearts and Shadow House. Again, that's the Hollow Sidewalks record release show, Wednesday, January 18th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Noontime Jamboree. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Curiosities, a vintage mall serving the West Side with space for over 70 dealers and a selection of vintage, retro, mid-century clothing, jewelry, and antiques. Curiosities is located at 12705 Southwest Beaver Dam Road in Beaverton. More at www.curiositiesvintage.com.